calling the Senate Revenue Committee to order with a quorum present. And we're going to launch right into testimony this morning. Rob Douglas, Ken Spaulding, Robert Harris. Come on.
Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much. Rob Douglas, representing the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants. This is a veteran committee, and I'm sure you realize the traditional role of the state society. We come before you each session describing what is taking place at the federal level, what those policy issues were, how those would affect Oregon income taxes, and stating what changes need to be made for Oregon to conform to the federal definition of income. Much hard work is done by the State and Local Taxation Committee of the Oregon Society of CPAs. They'll be working from the booklet that the committee has been provided, going through and describing those changes. And with that, I think I'll leave it to the experts.
Thank you. And we'll bring the experts up.
And Chairman Starr, if I can just say, the CPAs did a great job of outlining all the different changes that have occurred in federal law. But just so everyone knows, we'll be going through the numbers tomorrow, okay? So, you know, don't feel like you're trying to get from them, you know, how much this is going to cost the state. We'll go through all that tomorrow. They just are going to give you a great overview of all the different sections, and there's tons of federal law changes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kim Spaulding. And before you, you have our booklet that we have broken out by section, what we call A, B, and C. We'd like to begin with section C, with your permission, which covers the items that the federal government has changed the law in areas in which Oregon would be disconnected from if it does not take action.
Fine.
Okay, thank you. So on page 40 of the book is where I'd like to begin. Act Section 4 one section of this act, an act to amend Section 527 of the Internal Revenue Code. This one specifically relates to political organizations and gives the Secretary authority to waive taxes imposed for failing to file notices or reports. This change affects the federal tax system, but we bring it to your attention in case Oregon decides it wanted to change how it imposes taxes and penalties for failing to file these notices or reports. The next act is the Medicare Prescription Drug Improvement and Modernization Act of 2003. It's Section 1201H and relates to health savings accounts and deals with policy acquisition expenses of health savings accounts and that they don't need to be capitalized. Oregon, as you know, used a date-specific connection to the Internal Revenue Code as of 2002, and because this act was passed in 2003, Oregon does not connect to this section, to this change. And so that's kind of the theme that you'll see in this section C, is that most of these, the dates that the federal law was enacted was after 2002, to which Oregon currently ties to.
Can you clarify for them that the bigger picture, though, with the health savings accounts, we are connected with already, which is in your Section A? Yeah.
Right. This is just a very minor portion of health savings accounts, so don't let the name of this make you think that it covers all aspects of it. Oregon does tie permanently to the depreciation changes and changes in tax savings accounts like retirement plans and health savings accounts. This just relates specifically to the acquisition expenses of them. Yeah, thank you. Okay, on the next page, Act Section 1202 provides that certain federal subsidies under prescription drug plans are excluded from gross income. And our understanding from reading the analysis on this is that this relates to subsidies that the government is providing to sponsors of health plans for retirees that used to work for the company. So it's employers that are providing retirement benefits to retirees are now receiving a subsidy from the government. It is our belief that that is to help pay for those retirement benefits that the employers are providing. So I think that's our understanding of this change. Does that make sense to you guys? Okay. So the Military Family Tax Relief Act is the next act. Act Section 101, this all relates to members of the uniformed services, the armed forces. This relates to the exclusion of gains from the sales of principal residence. In order to qualify for the exclusion of gain, a taxpayer must own or live in their primary residence for at least two of the prior 5 years. This allows an extension of the 5 years up to 10 years for members of the armed services to get that exclusion of gain. Act Section 102, the amount of death gratuity benefit that's excludable is increased to $12,000. Oregon currently allows $3,000 exclusion. Act Section 103, exclusion for amounts received under Department of Defense Homeowners Assistance Program. This relates to values of homes, and they're allowed to exclude from income the benefits from that. Act Section 104 expands the combat zone filing rules to contingency operations. This relates to filing tax returns, paying taxes, filing claims for refunds, that sort of thing. So contingency operations now qualify for that, for those changes. Act Section 105, this act expands the definition of who is a member of a veterans organization. Who is a member is how they determine the exempt status of those organizations, and they've now expanded it to include lineal descendants. Act Section 106 clarifies dependent care assistant payments provided by Department of Defense to members of the uniformed services are excluded from income. This was a clarification, not necessarily a change in law. Act Section 108 suspends the tax-exempt status of terrorist organization and denies the charitable contribution deduction for those. You may have heard about that. That was in the news a little bit.
That one's safe, Mr. Chair.
Act Section 109 allows an above-the-line deduction for travel expenses of National Guard and reservists. Act Section 110, this act extends relief granted by the Victims of Terrorism Act of 2001 to astronauts who lose their lives in the line of duty. And so there were several different provisions that were provided to the victims of the terrorists, and those are identified below. There was an income tax exclusion for income earned in the year of death in the previous year. There's a death benefit exclusion for payments they receive, the benefit of dying. not anyone wants to be in that situation. And there was an estate tax reduction. So those have all been extended to astronauts who lose their life. And I'd like to hand over the microphone to Bob Karras.
Hi, my name is Robert Karras, CPA, Clackamas, Oregon. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm going to begin on page 45. My contribution to the efforts this year was to analyze parts of the American Jobs Creation Act of 2004. This act was enacted, this act became effective on October 22, 2004. And as Kim was saying, as with all the items in this section, none of these provisions would take effect without legislative action due to the fact that Oregon law currently calls for a fixed tie date back to December 31st of 2002. So Act Section 101 of the American Jobs Creation Act, and really the whole reason for its being was the first two Act sections. The repeal of exclusion for extraterritorial income. That at one time, the U.S. Congress had passed a tax benefit for people who exported, or for companies who exported their products overseas, made them in the U.S. and exported them overseas. That incentive has now been written out of the law. That incentive no longer exists, and Oregon law automatically conformed to the 2000 federal statute. Therefore, Oregon law allowed this incentive, this deduction for extraterritorial income. I always want to say extraterrestrial income, but that's a different thing. But after 2002, Oregon doesn't automatically conform. So therefore, without legislative action, this exclusion for extraterritorial income would continue to occur. Act Section 102 is the thing that Congress did to mitigate that repeal of that exclusion for extraterritorial income. And what they said was, we're just going to give every manufacturing company a... we're going to give every manufacturing company a benefit for the manufacturing activities, and it's an across-the-board deduction for starting at 3% and increasing to 9% of the 9% of the cost of 9% of the cost of manufacturing. And I understand that there's some talk here. So, is there a question or anything?
I'd be happy to. Senator George.
Thanks. Let's get back to 101, if you would. I'm really curious what Congress did here by providing a tax incentive for corporations producing goods outside of the U.S. of A.
No, it was for goods that were produced inside the United States. And I apologize if that's misleading in that regard. We have to summarize these laws into such a distilled form that it sometimes rather dense. But the benefit accrued only to companies who did the majority of their production within the United States and then sold the goods outside the United States. In other words, generating foreign trade income. Mm-hmm. The whole purpose of this and its predecessor statutes, which go all the way back to the mid-1970s, was to reward companies who do that.
And that still is the way this remains?
No, that rule has completely been written out of the federal tax law at this time.
What is this going to do relative to that issue?
The repeal, you mean?
Well, yeah, right. I mean, so we had an incentive for someone to produce in the United States and export.
Yes.
What's our incentive now?
That incentive is gone. The reason for the evolution was because our foreign trading partners objected to this deemed subsidy of exportation. The World Trading Organization and the general, the GATT, whatever that acronym stands for, found that, has a principle that subsidies of exports are illegal. If you want to belong to the WTO, you can't do it. And for years we fought them. For years we tried disguising it in different ways. We started out with the DISC. They didn't like that. We went to the FISC. They didn't like that. We went to ETI. They didn't like that. They kept catching us. And so, okay, so finally we finally learned a lesson, and Congress said, we're just going to give every manufacturing company a tax break. Doesn't matter where they sell their products, we're just going to give it to them. So that's where we stand. So the repeal of 101 gets us back in line with our foreign trading partners, and the enactment of 102 continues a benefit for manufacturing activities here in the United States.
Senator Chair Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bear with me. I have a cold. So what are the mechanics of the ETI? If I'm an Oregon company that would like to claim the deduction here rather than the federal credit, just walk us through how, or not an Oregon company, frankly, how the mechanics of the deduction would work.
I see the your question. Yes. It's been a long time since I've done one of these, I'd be honest with you. But let me just kind of briefly summarize what's going on. Basically, you look at the foreign trading gross receipts. You look at the, first of all, you have to have a product that's manufactured here in the United States. And you have to be selling it overseas. You have to have, I don't think you have to have a foreign presence any longer. Under one of the previous incarnations, the ones that I'm the more familiar with, I'll be frank with you, you had to have a foreign presence. I don't think that requirement is there any longer. But basically, there's an exemption, or a deduction, rather, that you take against your taxable income that's done on a separate schedule. You go through and you calculate your taxable income. And then you stop and you put that aside. And you look at your foreign trading activity, your foreign trading gross receipts. And you look at the profitability that you've earned on that foreign trading income. And then once you've figured out how much money you've made on that foreign trading income, which is as much as possible because, hey, you know, that's what I do for a living, is to grow that number to be the greatest it can be, you then multiply that by a ratio. I think it's like 15/23 of the net income that comes from that activity. And that becomes a deduction. And now we go back to the mainstream of your tax return, and we subtract away that 15/23 of the profit from that export activity. Now, that is not exactly the way this works, and believe me, my recollection of it is rather dim. But if I'm not mistaken, it's something in that. And if you'd like, we can study that and get back to you on exactly the mechanism.
And that's the one that was repealed.
That's the one that was repealed.
So do you
yes.
want to know what were you also wanting to know the new one?
Exactly. I mean, you know, the decision we have before us is on this: is do we connect with the deduction that Congress enacted? or don't we? And, you know, two things that we look at, Mr. Chair, are one is, are we creating huge accounting problems and requiring, I guess, for lack of a better word, two sets of books? And so it'd be helpful to hear from y'all. Is this one that you could easily and neatly decomport off the side and just do give your client, the business, the deduction for the federal and then separate that from the state, and then just the mechanics of how the Oregon company or one that's doing business here in Oregon, not an Oregon company, actually just the mechanics of how it flows on their tax form.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to address that, if you wouldn't mind. As someone who used to do this for a living, at least in its old incarnations, that was an extremely elaborate process. The process of identifying the foreign trading gross receipts, the process of allocating under all those rules, the allowable deductions against those gross receipts, to determine how much was going to be eligible for the subtraction under the under ETI was a tremendous amount of effort at the time that I was doing that type of work. Now again, at the time that I was doing this, it was in a different form, and in that form, it was even more elaborate than it was under ETI, but. It was a tremendous amount of work, I got to tell you that. And just simply, for a taxpayer to have on their federal tax return I must state that the OSCPA's bias is to try and to be in favor of conformity. We believe that conformity is at least a simpler tax system and makes it more the revenue more determinable and the administration simpler for all parties, not just us but also our peers and our cohorts at the Department of Revenue. But to have to go through on your federal return the manufacturing subtraction under Act Section 102 and then to go back on your Oregon return and go through all those gyrations to do the ETI on your Oregon return. With the amount of money that was involved, you know, some companies are going to just say, well, it's not worth it. You know what I mean? Looking at the cost benefit of it. If I could generate a 35% tax rate benefit on the ETI savings, that would mean something. But at only 6.6%, I might just say, hey, I don't know that we can really afford to do this, to go through all these gyrations. So that's a possibility.
I would like to add that you may not be aware, but this new deduction has not yet been in place for federal purposes for 2004. It doesn't come into play until 2005. So none of us practitioners have actually done the calculation for the tax returns that we all just completed. You know, the federal calculation is going to be completely different than the old method, and it's, you know, a percentage of the production activities. And so there's going to be, you know, extensive calculations on the federal, you know, to come up with federal taxable income, for which none of us have actually gone through. I've seen the extensive worksheets and that sort of thing. And then if you were to disconnect, then you would have to make that change on the Oregon return from what you've done for federal.
I'd like to throw in my two cents.
For the record, your name?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I'm Bruce Crone, a CPA with Morrissey Group in Oregon City. The exclusion isn't completely gone either. It's phased out. So that adds to the complications of the whole calculation.
Chairman, just to make sure everyone's clear, though, you know, with the exclusion for extraterritorial income. Okay, now this is something we discussed even last session, Chairman Deckard. You know, it was a part of that big Measure 30 and stuff that got put before voters. So if you do not connect with this, your company is going to be facing sanctions. So, I mean, I don't think there's a company in the state who would want to face WTO sanctions in order to keep an Oregon ETI exclusion. So you've got to be sensitive to that. So the ETI is really not something that it was any question about what it needed to be excluded. I mean, it needed to be removed, and that needed to not be an exclusion that was allowed. Now, the other one is 102, and that is just the deduction relating to domestic production activities. That is a new one. That is what was part of the discussion on the House. It was not the ETI. It was the 102 here, the deduction relating to those production activities just here in Oregon. And so that is something new, as they were saying, and it still has to be decided at the federal level what the rules are going to be and whatnot for what determines a production activity and things. But that is a deduction. So basically on Oregon's return, you would then add that back. So, you know, it's going to be on the federal return as a deduction. It will be identified, and then on Oregon return, if you didn't want it, you would just add it back. So that's just like any other add back. You know, we have Oregon add backs and additions, and that's what it would be like.
Thank you.
So may I continue then?
Yes, please.
Very good. All right. I think I've said pretty much about all I need to say about 101 and 102, so I'm going to move on to the S-corporation changes on page 46. The first of the S-corporation reform and simplification measures is that as they're expanding the ability of corporations to elect treatment as an S-corporation. S-corporations were limited to 75 shareholders under prior law. Under current Oregon law, they're limited to 75 shareholders. And now, under the new federal law, the number of shareholders is increased to 100. Furthermore, not only are husband and wife counted as a single shareholder, but members of the family are now considered as a single shareholder. So that greatly increases the ability of the of an S-corporation to reduce the number of shareholders that are counted and therefore extend that benefit, if you will. I'm not sure that it's a benefit, but benefit to more and more family members. And an interesting provision is that a family is defined as a common ancestor and all lineal descendants of the common ancestor, as many as five generations removed. Which really expands the number of. I did the math at one point, assuming that everyone had two children that survived, and I came up with a very large number of shareholders, but it wasn't as many as General Motors has. So I don't think General Motors is going to be able to elect S-Corp no matter what the federal Congress thinks. Under Oregon law, and here's the thing I'd like to call your attention to, under Oregon law, the definition of an S-corporation is still locked in with what it was as of December 31st of 2002, and you could wind up with the situation where a corporation was an S-corporation under federal law but not qualified under Oregon law, with the resultant differences in the treatment of the shareholders and their income, and the differences in the treatment of the corporation and whether it's paying any tax or whether it's not paying any tax, and we're talking about state or we're talking about federal. So just as a general principle, again, thinking about the conformity issue, thinking about the ease of administration issue, the members of our committee wanted to bring that issue to your attention and ask that even if full conformity isn't something that's on the table, that at least we consider expanding the realm of automatic conformity things like we have with depreciation, like we have with retirement plans and retirement savings accounts. Expanding the ambit of automatic conformity to the definition of what is a tax flow-through entity such as an S-corporation. There's other tax flow-through entities like real estate investment trusts and mutual funds, regulated investment companies. And we would like to see, if nothing else, a little bit more standardization on that as well. Again, with the goal of ease of administration. Moving on to page 47, at section 233, and following deal with additional S-corporation reforms. 233, Act Section 233 deals with expansion of eligible bank S-corporation shareholders to include in individual retirement accounts. Some banks have as shareholders individual retirement accounts. Those banks cannot elect to be treated as S-corporations because individual retirement accounts may not be shareholders of an S-corporation. But the federal Congress has carved an exception for that, and now banks who have IRAs as shareholders can be S-corporations. Other S-corporation provisions that are even more trivial than that are Act Sections 234 through 240. Disregard of unexercised, they're not trivial, they're trivial to me, I'm sorry. Disregard of unexercised powers of appointment in determining potential current beneficiaries of electing small business trusts. Transfers of suspended losses of S-corporations, incident to divorce, etc. Use of passive activity loss and at-risk amounts by qualified subchapter S trust income beneficiaries. Exclusion of investment securities income from the passive income test for bank S-corporations. Relief from inadvertently invalid qualified subchapter S subsidiary elections and terminations. information returns for qualified subchapter S subsidiaries, repayment of loans for qualifying employer securities. Then we're going to move on. That's pretty much the S corporation impact from the AJCA. And Act Section 243 now deals with improvements related to real estate investment trusts. And these headings are all directly off of the statute. So there's the word improvement really means liberalization. The Act has made liberalizing changes that affect the operating rules of real estate investment trusts and make it easier for those trusts to remain qualified as real estate investment trusts, make it easier for the real estate investment trusts to diversify their investments into things that were formerly hands-off. Again, this is a definitional thing. Oregon law, we could conceivably have a situation where a real estate investment trust was a taxable corporation under Oregon law because it violated these rules, and these rules hadn't been if these rules haven't been adopted under Oregon law. Act Section 247 talks about the modification of unrelated business income limitation. Not-for-profit organizations do pay income taxes. They pay it on unrelated business income, and this makes it easier for not-for-profit organizations to avoid having to pay income taxes when they've invested their excess funds in certain SBA guaranteed debentures that have been issued by a company licensed under the Small Business Investment Act. Of course, Oregon law would not change without action by the legislature and would make that income taxable to Oregon, make it that income taxable to not-for-profits that filed Oregon returns. Act Section 251 deals with exclusion from incentive stock options and employee stock purchase plan options. FICA and FUTA taxes are imposed on wages that are paid with respect to employment, obviously. And under prior law, it was unclear whether or not income that was resulting from the exercise of statutory stock options was subject to FICA and FUTA tax. And this act makes it clear that FICA tax does not apply to income which is received as a result of exercising stock options. And that is the end of my section, and I'm turning the microphone over to my esteemed colleague, Bruce Krohn.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bruce Krohn, CPA from Oregon City. I'm going to be covering what is principally the agricultural section of the American Jobs Creation Act. Act Section 311 provides some new rules for deferring gain from involuntary conversion of livestock. It used to be that you could reinvest the proceeds without including the gain in income for 2 years. The Act extends it to 4 years. Act Section 312 deals with reduction of patronage income for co-op dividends distributed on capital stock. And this is an Act section that allows a co-op to distribute these dividends and not lose its tax-exempt status. So it's a definitional thing for tax exempts, and I would suggest that you probably want to adopt this so that you don't have an organization that's tax-exempt on federal and not tax-exempt on state. Act Section 314 extends income averaging to fishermen and is coordinated with the alternative minimum tax. A couple of years ago, you extended the benefits of income averaging to farmers in Oregon, and the American Jobs Creation Act includes fishermen in the income averaging calculation. It's not really a taxable income determination item, but it's more of a fairness item. Fishermen have had a rough time the last couple of years, as have farmers, so extending the benefits of income averaging to fishermen like farmers would put them in the same position.
Mr. Chair, so what's the definition of income averaging?
You look at the income over a four-year period, and you look at the source of the income from the activity. If it's farmers, from farming. If it's fishermen, it's from fishing. And you average the income over that four-year period so that they don't have to pay as much tax. It'll happen when they have like three poor years and then one really good year that they'll see their taxes skyrocket. And so this allows them the benefits of income averaging for when they finally get their feet back on the ground in that fourth year. Okay. Act Section 315 deals with capital gains for outright sale of timber by landowners. It's a definitional thing about what constitutes a capital gain under Code Section 631, so that you could have capital gain on the federal return and not on the Oregon return. When you have capital gain on the federal return, it goes to a Schedule D where it's netted against capital losses. So you could potentially have different capital gains and losses for federal and Oregon purposes. Act Section 316 deals with cooperative marketing, including value-added processing of animals. And once again, this is a definitional thing for tax-exempt cooperatives. You want to have the same rules apply for tax exempts for federal and Oregon. Act Section 318 is the rural mail carriers' unreimbursed vehicle expenses that are deductible as a miscellaneous itemized deduction. Previously, if they had excess unreimbursed expenses, they were not deductible, and the law allows them to deduct them as a miscellaneous itemized deduction now. So Oregon does not automatically adopt this change because it affects taxable income.
Doesn't the post office, I know this is a naive question, but doesn't the post office, these are rural US, United States post office employees?
They're contractors.
Contractors. That's one.
Great. I don't.
Okay. Outsourcing.
Something you learn every day. I did not know that.
Act Section 319 deals with income from open access, nuclear decommissioning, asset exchange or conversion, and load loss transactions for pre-2007 tax years. Actually, the description was a little longer, and we shortened it for the benefit of those of us who have to read it. And this is another item that goes to maintaining what is necessary for a subchapter T cooperative to retain its status. And there's some tests involved with this kind of income. Act Section 320 deals with individuals whose student loans are repaid under a National Health Services Corp loan repayment program or similar state programs. And the Act provides that in the case of an individual, gross income does not include any amount received from a National Service Corps loan repayment program or under a state program described in the Public Health Service Act. And then it's important that in order for this exclusion, that the repayments, which would normally be taxable income, are provided on condition that the participants provide certain services. Act Section 321 is a safe harbor for timber REITs. If timber REITs engage in certain questionable transactions, and when I say questionable, I don't mean illegal. I mean questionable for purposes of them maintaining their special tax status. They've had to go get an IRS ruling that they can rely on that they're properly classifying the income. And that gets to be an expensive process to go out and get these rulings all the time. And the Act provides that for purpose of the REIT rules, a prohibited transaction will not include the sale of a property, which is a real estate asset. So this brings these rulings and codifies it into law. Act Section 331 deals with net income from publicly traded partnerships treated as qualified income for regulated investment companies, otherwise known as mutual funds. And mutual funds have to meet a certain gross income test. 90% of their income has to come from certain types of activities. And in the past, their investments in publicly traded partnerships have not been a qualifying activity. Well, this changes it to include income from the publicly traded partnership as part of the gross income qualifying income. Act Section 335, whaling captains may claim a charitable deduction for up to $10,000 of expenses incurred each year after 2004 in support of native Alaskan subsistence whaling. And this is a charitable contribution up to $10,000 that's allowed for these certain expenses. And if you're wondering what this Alaskan provision is doing in an Oregon analysis, it's possible that you might have someone from Oregon who's engaging in whaling activities in Alaska, and they may be filing a resident return or a non-resident return, But in any event, this charitable contribution will impact their federal taxable income.
Paul?
Yeah.
Do we have a fiscal on that provision for Oregon? I mean, do we have any? No.
We haven't identified
that. I'd be surprised if you can get a count on the number of potential taxpayers that would qualify under this.
I think the high seat is looking.
Act Section 340, allowance of an additional $10 million capital expenditure for small issue bonds issued after September 30th of 2009. This act just increases the number of qualifying organizations. And so potentially you could have somebody qualifying for federal and not for Oregon. And with that, I'll turn the American Jobs Creation Act analysis back to Bob.
Let's see. Page 53, Act Section 407. United States property not to include certain assets of controlled foreign corporations. In this Act Section, this Act Section makes it easier for shareholders of controlled foreign corporations to avoid having subpart F income that would be taxable. Act Section 411, treatment of certain dividends of regulated investment trusts. Here, a non-resident alien is subject to U.S. tax on the disposition of U.S. real property interests. But a U.S. real property interest includes an interest in a domestic corporation, which is a U.S. real property holding corporation. Therefore, a foreign person who sells domestic corporate stock can be subject to U.S. tax. And this act now makes it possible to, under certain circumstances, for a foreign person to sell stock in certain types of U.S. real property holding corporations to avoid U.S. Incurring U.S. tax. And Act Section 412 is another subpart F feature. This one deals with look-through treatment for sales of partnership interests. Under prior law, a foreign personal holding company income included the gain on the sale of a partnership interest, regardless of whether the partnership interest held passive income generating assets. It was deemed the partnership interest was deemed to be, in its own right, a passive income item. The Act changes that so that if you have a substantial position, 25% or more ownership in a partnership, then you're able to look through the assets of the through the partnership interest to the underlying assets. And then count only the passive income generating assets that are being sold at that level, rather than looking at the entire sale. Act Section 413 deals with repeal of foreign personal holding company rules and foreign investment company rules. The federal legislature has decided that this whole area of subpart F with foreign personal holding companies and foreign investment companies has gotten a little multi-layered, and they're trying, I think, here to simplify things. Other foreign corporation provisions, the Act makes other modifications. Act Section 414, determination of foreign personal holding company income with respect to transactions and commodities. These are items that are fairly narrow in scope and fairly limited even in impact, except to very narrow industries or even just to certain taxpayers in certain industries. Act Section 415, modification to treatment of aircraft leasing and shipping income, and Act Section 416, modification of exceptions under subpart F for active financing. Act Section 418 deals with modification of treatment of certain REIT distributions that are attributable to gain from sales or exchanges of U.S. property interests. In this situation, a REIT shareholder is subject to a 35% withholding tax on capital gains distributions and is required to file a U.S. tax return because it's a real estate investment. The real estate trust, you're looking through the real estate, the corporation to the underlying assets, and again, this foreign person would have to file because under the rules that we were just discussing a few moments ago. The Act discontinues the requirement that a foreign REIT investor file a U.S. tax return upon receipt of a capital gain distribution,
And but this only applies to publicly traded U.S. REITs and to REIT shareholders owning 5% or less of the REIT stock. So they're not giving everything away, but they're saying that, you know, if this is a a widely traded REIT and you're only a small piece of it, then we're not going to treat you as having disposed of a U.S. property interest. Act Section 419 deals with horse racing and dog racing. Non-resident aliens are subject to U.S. tax on gambling winnings from U.S. sources. Such income is subject to a flat 30% withholding tax. In a merged or commingled paramutual pool, a non-resident alien was formerly subject to U.S. tax on the portion of winnings allocable to U.S. races, but the Act now excludes from U.S. tax all winnings of a non-resident alien on wagers initiated outside the United States on paramutual pool horse or dog races. It's fairly narrow. I admit I'm not even sure that I would recommend betting on horse races if you didn't live in the country. Act Section 422 is a little bit more significant. Here's an incentive to reinvest foreign earnings in the United States, and this particular provision got a lot of press, and certainly in the tax publications that we all subscribe to here. U.S. companies own companies that are incorporated overseas, and they are not taxed on the activities of those corporations until and unless those corporations repatriate the earnings to the U.S. parent. So let's take Levi Strauss, for instance, that has set up a subsidiary in Bulgaria. In this situation, the federal Congress is allowing a temporary 85% dividends received deduction on such funds that are being repatriated if the funds are being used for certain prescribed purposes. This is different from prior year because without this benefit, the corporate parent would pay full income tax. There would be no dividends received deduction. Under Oregon law, my colleague colleague, Deborah Buchanan from the Oregon Department of Revenue, has pointed out that my text here is incorrect, and help me see that my text here is incorrect, and I'd like to suggest a change. And I apologize for not bringing an addendum sheet, but I didn't do that. Oregon law allows a dividends received deduction, according to federal law, as it existed on December 31st, 2002, and that's a 70%, 80% dividend received deduction. If an Oregon corporation receives a dividend, or an Oregon corporate taxpayer receives a dividend from another corporation, a 70% dividends received deduction is permitted. In other words, the 70% of that dividend is excluded from that corporation's, the receiving corporation's taxable income. If the 80% deduction kicks in if the receiving corporation earns 20% or more of the subsidiary corporation. And this rule would continue to be the case without legislative action. My text does not say that. My text is incorrect. So rather than having an 85% dividend received deduction as they would under federal law without legislative action, the 70/80% dividend received deduction would continue to apply. And these repatriated dividends would be excludable 70-80% on the tax returns corporate taxpayers.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Deckard.
Thank you. Can we stick with the Levi Strauss example?
Certainly. It's hypothetical. I mean, I don't have any personal knowledge of that. But.
Sure. It's just a good one for... Mm-hmm. I was staying with you on it. The parent is in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
but an operation in Bulgaria. All the sales in, say, the EU, European Union, they repatriate the income if we... and then you said, as defined, what do they have to do with that repatriated income? You said there was a definition of what they would have to do with it.
Oh, right. Actually, my outline briefly mentions, to qualify the last sentence of the paragraph, the second paragraph under 422, to qualify for the deduction, taxpayers' management and directors must establish a plan to reinvest the dividend in such a way to lead to job creation or retention other than executive compensation. There's been a tremendous amount of comment on exactly what is intended and embraced by this by this, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's a whole laundry list in the statute of the things that are okay, and the and my understanding is that we that that's a suggestion, but they're not limited to those things. But some of the things that they can't do, and the IRS has already caught on to this, is that they can't be used in some way to compensate the management of the company or other than executive compensation.
So there's a definition of job creation and retention mm-hmm. that we could go to look at, and I guess the second is it's in the same frame. The choice for us is: do we stick with the current 70% to 80%, or do we bump up what the federal government did to the 85%? Is basically the policy choice we have.
That's correct. Yes, and to answer the first question, I believe there are plenty of resources at this time to find out what exactly is encompassed. The statute is more broad as it always tends to be, but the Internal Revenue Service has already begun weighing in on this. Time is of the essence with this. This dividend received deduction, this 85% deduction, only applies for one tax year of any given taxpayer. That taxpayer has the ability to either pick a year that's already gone by or a year that they're already in the middle of. But once we're done, and that 85%, any dividends repatriated after that taxable year are going to be fully taxable again under federal law. Now, another point is that this dividend can't be just an ordinary dividend. If the subsidiary has been paying dividends year after year, and we've got a certain level of ordinary dividend, that's not going to cut it. The statute requires a significant uptick in the amount of dividends being repatriated in order to qualify for this special dividend received deduction. So that's another feature of the statute that I didn't call your attention to, but perhaps you may want to be aware of. Any other questions on that?
Senator George.
It seems like what the purpose of that is to say bring home foreign profits, invest them here, and create jobs.
Exactly. That is the stated intent of this.
Okay. I think Senator Smith worked on, if I remember correctly, Gordon Smith.
I believe he was part of the work group on this. The initiative was spearheaded by Representative Thomas in the House of Representatives. This was his baby. Act Section, if there's no more questions, I'll move on to Act Section 501. Thank you. Act Section 501 deduction, another interesting one for Oregonians and for the Oregon legislature, a deduction of state and local general sales taxes in lieu of state and local income taxes. We abruptly shift focus here to individual taxpayers filing Form 1040 and Oregon Form 40. Taxpayers can now take a deduction for state and local general sales taxes rather than an itemized deduction for state and local income taxes. This is the last time taxpayers were allowed to deduct sales taxes was in 1986. The purview of this statute has a limited time period, but in my humble opinion, I believe it's going to continue along after that. Oregon law, as it stands now, ties to the Internal Revenue Code as amended and in effect on December 31st of 2002, and basically you're only allowed to deduct state and local income taxes, and then if the state is Oregon, you don't get a deduction. But if, let's say, you're paying state taxes to California or you're paying taxes to Multnomah County, you can take the deduction of those on your Oregon income tax return. And that's the way the law is right now. I don't know what the legislature would like to do with this, but it's kind of an interesting question. Act Section 701 gets back down into sort of the minutia level again with Brownfield's demonstration program for qualified green buildings and sustainable design projects. Private activity bonds, which are state and local debt that's issued to finance permitted private activities, now have a new category. The new category is EPA-approved green buildings and sustainable design projects. Oregon law doesn't recognize this new category of tax-exempt bonds, and without reconnect, there would potentially be a taxable income to the recipients of interest on these type of bonds. Act Section 702 deals with the exclusion of gain or loss on the sale or exchange of certain brownfield sites. Tax-exempt organizations are now allowed to buy, improve, and sell brownfield sites. and not have to pay unrelated business income tax on that activity under federal law. Act Section 703 is designated as civil rights tax relief. There's been a substantial amount of controversy between taxpayers and the Internal Revenue Service in prior years about whether or not legal fees that are paid in connection with various tort actions are excludable from taxable income when the award from the court itself is not taxable. This act provides an above the line deduction, not an itemized deduction now, but a deduction in computing adjusted gross income for attorney fees and costs paid by or for the taxpayer in connection with any claim of unlawful discrimination, certain claims against the federal government, or a private cause of action under the Medicare secondary payer statute. And again, my text here outlines the controversy. Prior law did not discuss whether attorney fees were deductible above the line or as a much less beneficial miscellaneous itemized deduction. This issue has been the cause of much litigation. The federal circuits are split. After I wrote my outline, we found that the Supreme Court ruled on this issue. But despite the Supreme Court's ruling, this statute now overrides part of that with respect to lawyer fees, attorney fees paid in connection with civil rights style actions, these types of actions. Note that the Act does not discuss where to deduct attorney fees and costs in litigation other than with these types. The effective date of this is October 22nd of 2004. Oregon law doesn't discuss this, so under Oregon law, presumably, you would be taxed in full on the receipt of the judgment, and then a taxpayer would be forced to deduct these attorney fees as itemized deductions, even though on their federal return they were not appearing on Schedule A as an itemized deduction. Act Section 708 talks about a new method of accounting for naval shipbuilders. Taxpayers must use the percentage of completion method to determine taxable income from long-term contracts. Certain shipbuilding contracts are permitted to be accounted for using a special hybrid 40-60 percentage completion method of accounting and blended with the capitalized cost method. This is a great deal, but the federal Congress has decided to restrict the use of this special accounting method on qualified naval ship contracts to the first 5 years of the contract. And after those 5 years are over, they have to recapture that income and start paying taxes on all of the money that they saved prior to year six. Tax treatment of expatriated entities and their foreign parents. There's been a lot of press about this. Companies that have reorganized to take their headquarters outside the United States, and I'm trying to remember the one that's the most notorious of these. I can't remember the name of the company, but the company had been a U.S. corporation for years and years and years. It was a very old, well-established corporation, and one day realized, you know, we'd pay a lot less taxes if we were incorporated in Bermuda, so why don't we reincorporate in Bermuda, keep all of our existing shareholders? So they did that. What this does is it basically slaps the wrists of anybody who tries to do something like that in various ways. Act Section 803, reinsurance of United States risks in foreign jurisdictions. Prior law authorizes the Treasury Secretary to allocate or recharacterize tax attributes, things like deductions, credits, income, between two related parties who have entered into a reinsurance agreement. And this act section does is to clarify that this authority also includes situations in which the related persons are engaged in cross-border transactions. Apparently there was some controversy about that, and apparently the taxpayers were successful, because otherwise this rule wouldn't be here. This is courtesy of the Internal Revenue Service, who felt that was wrong for the court to have held that way. Act Section 833, disallowance of certain partnership loss transfers. In some cases, a partner will contribute property to a partnership, which is what's called built-in loss property, property whose fair market value is below its adjusted basis. And we have rules already about preventing the transfer of those benefits, the higher deductions, the deductions in excess of fair market value, to other partners in the partnership. However, if the contributing partner's interest has been liquidated, it appears, based on court rulings, that such losses, those built-in losses that weren't supposed to be transferred to the other partners, now have nowhere to go but to those other partners. This statute effectively eliminates the ability of the partnership to transfer those built-in losses to the other to the other partners. Act Section 834. No reduction of basis under Section 734 in stock held by a partnership and a corporate partner. This is a situation where a partnership has as one of its partners a corporation and at the same time owns as an investment stock in that corporate partner. In this situation, the Act prohibits a partnership from decreasing the basis of corporate stock issued by a partner or related person. Act Section 835 deals with the repeal of FASITS and changes to the REMIC rules. 1996, Congress created a new type of statutory entity called a Financial Asset Securitization Trust, and basically the 2004 Jobs Creation Act repeals Financial Asset Securitization Trusts, which under Oregon law would be continued somehow in a never-never-land kind of way to exist under Oregon law. I can't imagine how, but I'm sure that there's a way without our beloved full conformity. Act Section 836, limitation on transfer or importation of built-in losses. This is a situation where under Section 351 of the Corporation Formation Section, a foreign person is bringing in property into the United States that has a built-in loss, like we were talking about earlier, a situation where the adjusted basis of the property exceeds its fair market value. In this situation, the Act provides that if such a built-in net loss is imported in the U.S. In a tax-free reorganization under Code Section 351, then the basis of the property will be its lower fair market value. So the benefits from depreciating that property will not be available, because you'll be stuck with fair market value rather than your carryover basis. Next page, Act Section 837 clarifies what a banking business constitutes for purposes of determining investment in earnings in U.S. property. This is a fairly narrow one, but it was the result of an interesting court case called the Limited. A controlled foreign corporation's 10% shareholders are taxed on their pro rata shares of subpart F income. And in addition, such shareholders are also taxed on their shares of the CFC's earnings on investments in certain U.S. property. The term U.S. property, however, does not include deposits with persons carrying on the banking business. And in the case of the Limited, the Limited got an interesting benefit by allowing a foreign corporation to invest its excess capital in a person carrying on the banking business, which happened to be a subsidiary of the Limited, whose only mission in life was to run the credit card company that the Limited's own in-store credit cards. The Act said, you know, we don't think that statutory or judicial outcome is correct. And it now circumscribes the definition of what is a lot more clear and a lot more narrow about what a banking business is. It has to be a bona fide bank. It has to be a bank that's defined under the Bank Holding Company Act. And Act Section 838 denies a deduction for interest on underpayments attributable to non-disclosed reportable transactions. Elsewhere in our outline, in the Section Bs that we are probably not going to be discussing today, the federal legislature has greatly increased the penalties attributable to losses that are generated from certain types of transaction called listed transactions and reportable avoidance transactions. A corporation which incurs interest expense payable to the federal government as a result of having these losses disallowed is now, under the Act, not allowed to deduct the interest expenses, even though corporations ordinarily are permitted to deduct any interest expense that they incur. This was seen to be a kind of a backdoor benefit. So, you know, you're paying your penalties and all that kind of stuff. You can't deduct your penalties. That's fine. But now here they're getting to deduct the interest expense. It doesn't seem right. So now we're not even allowing them that.
And that's the end of my bit of the presentation. I turn the microphone over to Ken Spaulding.
Thank you. I'll continue on. Section 840 disallows the exclusion of gain from the sale of a principal residence if it was acquired in a like-kind exchange within the prior 5 years. Section 841 deals with mismatching of income and expenses between a foreign corporation, a controlled foreign corporation, and a U.S. shareholder. Section 845 expands the disallowance of deduction for interest on convertible debt. Section 848 adds a new limitation on deductions associated with leases to tax-exempt organizations. So there you have tax-paying entities leasing property to tax-exempt organizations. They can only deduct expenses up to the income they receive. There are similar rules for passive activities. Section 882 provides that charitable contributions of patents or similar property can be deducted only to the lesser of fair market value or adjusted basis. Section 883 provides that requires increased reporting for non-cash charitable contributions, and now corporations must have qualified appraisals of property with value exceeding $5,000. You may have heard about the next one. It got a lot of publicity. Section 884 deals with donations of cars, boats, and airplanes and limits a donor's charitable contribution to the lesser of the amount of the value or the amount the donee organization sells it for. Section 888, modification of straddle rules, which are offsetting positions with respect to actively traded personal property, usually securities, permits taxpayers to identify offsetting positions and clarifies the treatment of those positions. Section 893 applies to a U.S. holding company with a foreign parent. It requires that a liquidating distribution by a U.S. holding company to a foreign corporation be treated as a dividend if the holding company was in existence less than 5 years. Section 896 states that when a partnership transfers a capital or profits interest in the partnership to a creditor in satisfaction of the debt, that the partnership recognize cancellation of indebtedness income. The next page, Section 897, relates to readily tradable debt and expands the list of taxpayers who are ineligible to use the installment sale treatment. Section 898 limits the total of money plus other property that a corporation can distribute to creditors tax-free in a reorganization. Section 899 clarifies the definition of what constitutes preferred stock. Section 905 relates to the exercise of stock option and treats anyone who disposes of the stock to comply with the federal conflict of interest requirements as having met the two-year holding period so that the income will get capital gains treatment. Section 907 limits the employer deduction for entertainment expenses, especially related to the fair market value of using facilities. And they can only deduct the amount that the employee has included in income. Section 909 changes how gains are taxed on the sales or dispositions to implement FERC restructuring policy, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And they can now recognize the gain over an 8-year period of time. So Bruce is going to cover the last of our Section C items.
Okay, the next act is the Museum and Library Services Act 2003. Act Section 503 deals with the definition of a public library. The next two act sections are from the Pension Funding Equity Act of 2004. The bulk of that tax legislation deals with definitional items for qualified plans, and these are the only two act sections that step outside of the pension area and deal with deductions or exemptions. Act Section 205 deals with distinguishing between amounts returned by a mutual life insurance company to policyholders as customers and amounts distributed to them as owners of the mutual companies. The new provision repeals the rule requiring reduction of certain deductions of a mutual life insurance company. Act Section 206 clarifies an exemption from tax from small property and casualty insurance companies. Used to be that as long as your gross receipts did not exceed $350,000, you were exempt, and then they raised the limit to $600,000. And now we go into the Working Families Tax Relief Act of 2004, commonly known as WFDRA. Act Section 104 deals with the definition of earned income and now includes combat pay, and this is important for the calculation of the earned income credit. And Oregon also has an earned income credit, so it will be a definitional item for the calculation of that credit. Act Section 105 deals with the application of ECTRA sunset to this title. Provisions under this title will sunset as provided under Title IX of ECTRA, which is 2010, I believe. Act Section 201 is the uniform definition of a child. It was expanded in WFDRA. Definition of a qualifying child includes a couple more categories of individuals having certain specified relationships. It would be possible without reconnect that you would have a dependent on the federal return who didn't qualify on an Oregon return. Act Section 202 modifies the definition of head of household, also getting back to the qualifying child definition. Act Section 205 deals with modifications of the earned income credit, and it adopts the definition of qualified child that we mentioned earlier.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Paul, you may not have an answer to this. Does this get Senator Winters? Is that her bill?
Yeah.
That section gets her bill. Okay.
It was the grandparent she was in.
Grandparent. Thank you.
Okay, Act Section 206 deals with modification of deductions for personal exemptions for dependents. It eliminates the support test and will replace it with a residency requirement. So this is once again a definitional item relating to qualifying child. Act Section 207 has various technical and conforming amendments. And the code sections that are cited are 2, 21, 25, and 51 in this section. Act Section 302 deals with parity in the application of certain limits to mental health benefits and extends the co-provisions relating to mental health parity to benefits for services furnished on or after the date of enactment and before January 1st of 2006. Act Section 306 extends the deduction for contributions for donations of scientific property and computer technology in taxable years beginning before 1106, so it extends them for 2004 and 2005. Oregon provides a credit for the donation of computers or scientific equipment, and it's computed with reference to Code Section 170. Act Section 307 deals with the deduction for certain expenses of school teachers. It's an above-line $250 deduction. It's effective for tax years beginning after 12/31/03. So for 2004 tax returns, it was an add-back on all Oregon returns. Act Section 308 deals with the expensing of environmental mediation costs, and it allows taxpayers to elect to treat certain environmental remediation expenditures that would otherwise be chargeable to the capital account as deductible in the year paid or incurred. And the provisions extended through the end of 2005. Act Section 314 deals with taxable income limits on percentage depletion for oil and natural gas produced from marginal properties, and it extends the suspension of the 100% of taxable income limit on the amount deductible for marginal wells. There's a handout that we you should have. It deals with bills that passed after the American Jobs Creation Act. We went to press with this very thick booklet, and Congress didn't stop creating and passing new legislation. So we've got four of the ones that were enacted towards the they started in December, and then there's the one in January. if you look at that, the first one is a recommendation A, which we'll be covering shortly. It deals with church plan bills for YMCA retirement funds, and this deals with qualifying as a pension fund, and Oregon is automatically connected to anything dealing with pensions. So even though this was enacted in late December, Oregon automatically reconnects to this bill. The next two items, the excise tax on arrows bill and the Internet Tax Non-Discrimination Act, are recommendation Bs because they don't deal with Internal Revenue Code provisions regarding taxable income. The excise tax is an excise tax, and the Internet Tax Non-Discrimination Act deals with a tax similar to a telephone tax. And on the second page is the last recommendation C. It's a Tsunami Tax Relief Act that was enacted on January 7th that allowed those people making contributions for qualifying tsunami relief organizations to deduct contributions made in the month of January on their 2004 tax returns.
Okay. Questions?
So now we'd like to move to the section A of the booklet, which covers items that Oregon automatically connects to based on what they are, which is usually depreciation, like Bruce said, pensions, tax savings accounts. So on page 1, Act Section 1 goes back to an Act to amend Section 527 of the Internal Revenue Code, which again deals with the state and local political organizations. And they're not required to provide notice to the Secretary of the Treasury, and electronic filing is now sufficient for them with regards to their filing requirements. Act Section 2, this act clarifies the amount of income a minister may exclude related to the fair market value of housing they receive. So that was the Clergy Housing Allowance Act of 2002. So that's the new act. Page 3 is a Holocaust Restitution Tax Act. Some of these acts don't contain much. Act Section 2 removes the 2010 sunset date with respect to income exclusion for restitution received by Holocaust victims. The next act, Jobs and Growth Tax Relief Reconciliation Act, Section 201 deals with bonus depreciation. You may have heard about that. Bonus depreciation was increased from 30 to 50%. And was extended through 2004. And also the deduction for autos was increased.
So that's now completed, the bonus depreciation?
It's now, yes, the bonus 2004 was last year.
Last year.
Mm-hmm. Act Section 202 deals with the Section 179 depreciation deduction. It was increased from $25,000 to $100,000. And the annual purchase limitation used to be $200,000, now it's $400,000. Another act, Medicare Prescription Drug Act, Section 1201. This provision created health savings accounts. These have also gotten publicity that allow tax-free contributions when made in conjunction with a high-deductible health care plan. Section 1201 allows that cafeteria plans may now offer health savings accounts as part of their menu of choices. So this kind of is in conjunction with the other one. The American Jobs Creation Act of 2004, Section 201, extends the increased Section 179 deduction for two more years. So keep in mind that this booklet's covering a two-year period of time, and so you're getting the condensed version. What I just said extended the 179 deduction. This one now extends that deduction for two more years. Or the other one increased it, this one extends it. Section 211 changed the depreciation lives for qualified restaurant property to 15 years. Section 222 authorized the Secretary of HUD to enlarge renewal communities. Section 242, the act modifies the method of depreciation for certain industries, including film and television. I think Bob Karras is.
And speaking of film and television industries, Section 244 allows film producers to recover the expense of film production up to recover them in the year of production or in the year of expenditure up to $15 million. So this, rather than being capitalized and being depreciated over the economic life of the production, these costs can be expensed as long as the cost of the production is less than $15 million. Act Section 245 provides a credit for the maintenance of railroad track. The Act now gives a new 50% credit for railroad maintenance expenditures, and although this is a credit provision on the federal books, it has an implication because the railroad track, the cost of the railroad track that is eligible for the credit, is that cost basis is reduced, and so therefore less depreciation is permitted. And the word depreciation is in there, so because of that, you would think that we were on automatic conformity, but the difference is that the Oregon taxpayer isn't going to be able to claim that federal credit on its Oregon tax return, so we're going to have a difference in basis between your federal basis and your state basis. And Oregon law already provides an automatic adjustment it's not even part of the last legislative session, provides an automatic adjustment that allows taxpayers to recoup the full amount, the uncredited amount of their basis in respect to this type of a transaction. On the next page, page 8, Act Section 322 talks about another amortization provision, actually. Up to $10,000 of reforestation expenditures can be expensed for qualified timber property. Previously, taxpayers were able to elect to amortize reforestation expenditures over a 7-year period of time, but now under the new federal law, the first $10,000 can be written off completely right up front, rather than being amortized. The reason why this is kind of interesting is that after I wrote this up, our committee believed that this being a cost recovery type of a provision, cost recovery being depreciation, amortization, cost recovery is a way of describing that. We felt that this would automatically be part of the rolling reconnect on depreciation that was enacted by the Oregon legislature in 2002. But we find that the Department of Revenue doesn't think so, and the Department of Revenue reads the rolling reconnect on depreciation and similar items to be much narrower, not much narrower, but to be narrower. And narrower means amortization's in, out, depreciation's in. So that was an eye opener for me and the other members on the committee. So we felt that we'd like to call it to the attention of the legislature. And if nothing, you know, if full reconnect isn't envisioned, if rolling reconnect on all fronts isn't necessarily envisioned, if nothing else, that we would like to see a clarification of what really is intended by rolling reconnect with respect to cost recovery positions. We'd like to see cost recovery to include amortization. Act Section 336 extends the in-service deadline for certain aircraft placed in service before January 2006. Act Section 337, there's a bit of an error here on page 8. The last Act Section synopsized here, it mentions 336 and 337, but 336 has already been covered in the previous paragraph, and it should just be a 337 there. I know that's very important. That's the rule with respect to whether or not original use requirement is met on multiple property leases. And this has to do with a taxpayer's ability to take what we call bonus depreciation, which is that 30 or 50% additional deduction at the beginning of the life of a fixed asset. That's really what this is all about. It's a rather narrow clarification, I suppose, of a previously written rule. Act Sections on the next page 9, Act Sections 338 and 339 talks about small refiners who are permitted to expense up to 75% of the capital cost of complying with the EPA diesel fuel sulfur control requirements. It allows small refiners to take a deduction for expenditures that ordinarily would have had to have been capitalized, when those expenditures are mandated to meet EPA fuel sulfur requirements. Act Section 704 changes the class life for certain motorsports racetrack facilities. If a taxpayer owns a sports arena that has a motorsports racetrack, then that person would be affected by this provision, and it allows a 7-year period of depreciation rather than the existing 15-year period for those items that are connected with the motorsports racing activity. Act Section 706 is a benefit for certain Alaska natural gas pipeline property. Allows it to be treated as depreciated over a 7-year period rather than the current 15-year period. So there's a real benefit there because we're taking the depreciation over a shorter period of time, saving the people who own these pipelines tax dollars. Act Section 709 is a narrow, fairly narrow modification of the minimum cost requirements for transfers of excess pension assets. It allows companies a little bit more flexibility with dealing with retiree benefits and without having to concern themselves with the disqualification of their retirement plan. Act Section 847 reforms tax treatment of certain leasing arrangements, talking about leases to governmental entities and other tax exempts, including the tribes. Not only are tangible property now subject to these depreciation life extending rules, but now intangibles such as software are also now subject to these rules. Act Section 885, treatment of non-qualified deferred compensation plans. Non-qualified deferred compensation plans are not the tax favored type of retirement plans. But now, even non-qualified deferred compensation plans are now under much stricter regulation than formerly. Under Act Section 886, amortization of intangibles to sports franchises, the Act extends 15-year amortization for intangibles to sports franchises, including player contracts. Prior law excluded such intangibles from 15-year amortization. This is a good thing for people who own sports teams, that in the past amortization was prohibited. You couldn't determine the life. The life of the asset is not known, and you would not necessarily have the benefit of, or maybe a detriment. I'm not sure. Maybe it's meant to be a detriment. But in any event, you're stuck with 15 years, like it or not. So there you are. And again, here is an issue where the Department of Revenue called to our attention that perhaps our practitioners' casual understanding of the statute, the Oregon statute, which calls for rolling reconnect on cost recovery items. The Department of Revenue says this is amortization, it's not covered, you guys got to be careful about that. So we're being careful about that, and I thank my colleagues at the Department of Revenue for calling that to my attention. Act Section 901, class lives for utility grading costs. Currently, electric transmission and distribution land grading improvements are depreciated over a 7-year life, while other assets used in that business have a 20-year life. So there's kind of a nice thing, it's kind of upside down, but the Act now delays or stretches out the cost recovery period of those land grading costs to 15 and 20 years. Act Section 902, another amortization item, consistent amortization period for intangibles. This deals with startups, and this is one where a lot of our smaller taxpayers in the state of Oregon, corporate taxpayers and others are affected. The federal tax law now, instead of requiring capitalization and amortization of startup costs, the tax law now allows companies to write off the first $5,000. The balance would be amortizable over 15 years. So this it's kind of a good thing and a bad thing. The bad thing, of course, the good thing is obvious. The bad thing is that instead of being recoverable over 5 years, now you have to go over 15. Again, this was in recommendations A, but it really belongs in C. And finally, for my section, for my bit here, Act Section 910, depreciation of certain passenger automobiles. And this is something that the Oregon legislature has grappled with in the past as well. Passenger vehicles over 6,000 pounds were exempt from limits on depreciation in Section 179 expensing that applied to lighter luxury vehicles. This act, pulled back a little bit on that benefit and placed a $25,000 cap on the amount that can be expensed under Section 179 for sport utility vehicles, as defined, over 6,000 pounds and up to 14,000 pounds. The act, however, still allows the taxpayer to take regular depreciation and through December 31st, 2004, to take the 50% additional first-year depreciation deduction. So this is kind of a little bit of a take back here for people who own SUVs between 6,000 and 14,000 pounds.
So, I'm sorry, yes. Mr. Chair. So what's the policy now, beginning January 1st, 05? But is that the 50%?
Well, for the question, I guess to redirect the question, it would be for what?
For sports utility vehicles.
For sports utility vehicles, the situation is actually effective October 22nd of 04. You had an SUV that was over, if you had an SUV that was under 6,000 pounds, there was no doubt about it. It was subject to the limitations on any other automobile. If you had an SUV that was between 6 and 14,000 pounds, then let's say that SUV cost you $50,000. Let's say the SUV cost you $45,000. Instead of taking the entire $45,000 as the Section 179 deduction that you could do on October 21st, on October 22nd, you were stuck with capping the Section 179 deduction at $25,000. And then the balance of the cost, the remaining $20,000, would be recovered under the regular rules, not the automobile rules, but just would be recovered under the regular rules that are allowed for any other asset that is not eligible for Section 179. So that would be, through December 31st, 04, but now we're talking about 05. So the 50% bonusing thing is gone.
Gone as a...
But you can still take it over a five-year life because it's a vehicle, and so you get to depreciate it over a five-year life. So the first year's depreciation would be, 32% of the cost of the vehicle. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's a pretty substantial benefit. I mean, someone who buys a $45,000 SUV gets quite a bit of goodies. Interestingly enough, those rules, although they were appealed for SUVs, you know, that unlimited expensing, it wasn't repealed for pickup trucks. One of my clients came to me and says, I don't want to buy an SUV, I want to buy a pickup truck. And the rule's still okay. So if you spent $45,000 on a pickup truck that was over 6,000 pounds, you write off the whole cost. No problem. It's SUVs that got nailed. So that's kind of a weird little nook and cranny of the law, you know, little fun little avenue to run down. Any other questions about that? That's the end of my presentation for the AJCA here, and I'm turning the microphone over to Mr. Bruce Crum.
Okay, now we're going to talk about the Pension Funding Equity Act of 2004. This was federal legislation meant to assist industries, and when I say industries, you can think Greyhound, all the airlines, and a lot of old line blue-collar type entities, steel, that kind of entities back east. These industries were having trouble meeting their pension obligations. They had defined benefit plans whose costs were swelling, and they needed some relief, or they were looking at potential bankruptcy. So the federal government stepped in and realized that there was a problem, and so they drafted this legislation as a starting point to give relief to these industries. Act Section 101 provides a temporary replacement of the 30-year Treasury rate with a rate based on the investment-grade long-term corporate bonds. And the benefit of this is that those bonds have a higher yield, and when your investment has a higher yield, you need less to fund it. So the contribution that they had to make to fund these pensions was less because they changed the measurement. Now, it's important in that these pension plans need to be qualified plans. They need to meet their minimum funding requirements. So the reason this is an A is because it's a pension item, and the Oregon statutes don't want to recognize different qualified plans for federal and state purposes. I mean, it opens up a whole can of worms as far as how you tax distributions and what contributions are deductible. You have people moving from state to state, and are they bringing their basis along with them? So in the past, we've always had a permanent tie in the pension area. Act Section 102 deals with the election of an alternative deficit reduction contribution. And so it elects, certain employers can elect to make a reduced contribution of their plan for a plan year beginning at after December 27th of 2003 and before December 28th of 2005. And they can make this election for 2 years. And it's only available for employers that are a commercial passenger airline or an entity engaged primarily in the production or manufacture of a steel mill product or the processing of iron ore pellets, or an organization described in Section 501(c)(5) that was established on June 30th, 1955, apparently a special interest organization. Mm-hmm. Don't know if more than a handful that would fit that description. Act Section 103 deals with multi-employer plan funding notices. The new provision requires multi-employer plans to provide more detailed funding notices to its plan participants and to each employer that is a participant in the multi-employer plan. Previously, they were not required to do so. Act Section 104 deals with an election for deferral of charge for the portion of a net experience loss. And under the minimum funding rules, the amount of contributions required for a plan year is generally the plan's normal cost for the year, plus that year's portion of other liabilities that are amortized over a period of years. So it elects, it allows the multi-employer plans to elect to defer the beginning of the amortization of those net experience losses for up to 3 plan years. So this net experience loss is in addition to their required funding amount. So it allows them to fund it at a lesser amount. Act Section 201 deals with a 2-year extension of the transition rule to pension funding requirements. It applies only to plans sponsored by a company engaged primarily in interurban or interstate passenger bus service. So this sounds like the Greyhound benefit plan. Act Section 202 deals with disputes involving pension plan withdrawal liability. This law shifts the burden back to the plan sponsor for specific transactions which occurred before 1999, at least 5 years before the date of the withdrawal. Act Section 203, Congress and Defined Pension, Congress and Defined Benefit Pension System Reform. This is simply a directive to Congress to work out a more permanent replacement for the pension discount rate used for the defined benefit plan calculations. Act Section 204, extension of transfers of excess pension assets to retiree health accounts. It allows a qualified transfer of those excess assets to a separate account within the plan, and they can now make this without losing their qualified plan status. On the next page, it's the Working Families Tax Relief Act, Act Section 316. Allows accelerated depreciation of business property on Indian reservations, and it extends the eligibility to qualified Indian reservation property placed in service before January 1st of 2006. So it's a 1-year extension. It was previously going to expire at January 1st of 2005. Act Section 319 eliminates the phase-out deduction for clean fuel vehicle property for 2004 and 2005. Under previous law, they were going to have 25% of the deduction removed in 2004 and 50% removed in 2005, and now it extends the full amount for those 2 years. Act Section 322 deals with availability of medical savings accounts. When they established medical savings accounts, they had a cutoff of December 31st of 2003 for people to apply. There was supposed to be a ceiling amount of $750,000, and they decided to extend it because they couldn't find 750,000 people, and they wanted to provide an additional amount of time for these medical savings accounts applicants. Act Sections 401 to 408 are tax technical corrections. It seems like a bill never gets through Congress without requiring correction. So there's a series of corrections in Act Sections 403 to 408 that deal with previous law that was passed prior to 123102 and to which you automatically reconnect to, and then two provisions that deal with health savings accounts and qualified dividends from acts passed after 123102. And that concludes our discussion of A's.
Mr. Chair, what's your pleasure? I have a bill to carry on the Senate floor, which is now in session.
I don't want to have to bring a panel back. I know this is a busy time for you, or just getting after a very busy time. I think we're in good shape for... Yes, ma'am.
Well, I'd like to comment. We don't need to discuss items in Section B if you don't want to, because really what they are changes that the federal government has made that don't impact Oregon in any way. And so they're there for your enjoyable reading. Put yourself to sleep. They're mostly tax credits and deductions that apply to the federal tax system. And so you really shouldn't need to concern yourself with most of them or any of them. We can read them to you if you'd like. But.
So if I could ask the panel just one, thank you, that actually helps us conclude for today. But I guess the one general question that goes through my mind, I remember when we went through this 2 years ago, is what if you were sitting in our chairs and going through the decision? I know the CPAs have made a conscious decision to say you're the policymakers, we're here to provide good information to you. But what do you think the questions we should be asking ourselves as we look at this big, and I'm going to take it home with me tonight, this packet, in terms of connecting and disconnecting, I guess what 2 cents would you put in our hands as we enter in this, at least in the state Senate?
Mr. Chair, I think one thing you have to consider is compliance and the ability of the taxpayers who are completing their own returns. How are they going to track all these differences? It gets, you know, once you get through the federal return, it's awfully complicated, and you spend a lot of mental energy getting through it. When you get to the Oregon return, it shouldn't be that difficult. We've always been an AGI state, and you should just take the federal number, and you should be able to go down the front of the form and complete all those items. The additions and subtractions should be kept to, I think, a minimum, because it's too much for the ordinary taxpayer to remember. And although a lot of taxpayers use services that we provide and that other preparation services provide, I think more and more taxpayers are preparing their own returns using software and filing online. And those are the people that are going to have difficulties if there's any difficulty in compliance. Mm-hmm. So that's what I would suggest.
I think another our colleagues at the Department of Revenue could probably speak more effectively to this, but I believe that a system that is easy to administer is one that is predictable, one that has and the difficulty is that, you know, we're talking about starting with the federal, which isn't an easy system to understand or administer, and my greatest, you know, my criticism really should be aimed at what's in the federal statute, but nevertheless, a system which is relatively easy to administer is one that's effective and predictable, derives predictable revenues, I think, in my humble opinion. So again, you know, not only from the perspective of the taxpayers and their representatives, but also from the Department of Revenue, who is charged with understanding the law, explaining the law to the average taxpayers, and dealing with errors and omissions and so forth, and going to courts and having differences of opinion and all that. The simpler it is, the better it is. That's my drum that I keep beating.
Well, thank you very much. And those others signed up, as you probably have already heard, we're not going to have any additional testimony today, and we're going to close the hearing and adjourn the Senate Revenue Committee for today.